Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Dame Anne Owers, until recently the first female chief inspector of prisons. A long-time human rights campaigner, she has spent years immersing herself in the problems of people on the margins, those fraught, tangled and tender areas of human existence where dysfunction and often bad luck come together. Born into a coal mining community in the northeast, she went on to study at Cambridge, lived for a time in Zambia, and worked on race relations in Brixton when the riots kicked off. Prison mirrors society, she says, and she believes the principles of prison must be that we are trying to rehabilitate them, and that's for the victims as well as for the benefit of the people in prison. So Anne Owers, crime, justice, rehabilitation, they are areas of contention and areas of high emotion. How do you keep your professional head in amongst all of that? Are you somebody who can leave that in the professional area and go home and think about other things, or do you take it with you?
I think to an extent you've got to be able to leave it behind, but you also need to kind of process it as well. So my husband now would often say when I was chief inspector that Fridays when I came back from the prison, there would be a kind of splurge of things that I would need to talk about. But you do need to keep that distance, clearly, and you won't be any good at what you're trying to do if you're totally absorbed in it.
And this idea, the premise of yours that all prisoners deserve rehabilitation, of course, you'll be aware that plenty of people think most prisoners deserve to rot in jail. They're not so bothered about the rehabilitation.
Of course, there are people who, quite rightly, will never come out of prison. But the majority of the people I saw in prison had come there through a route that was explicable and that you could potentially change. I think one of the things that comes to me very strongly from my own background, myself and my two cousins were the first people in our family ever to go to university. That's not because we arrived from a different planet. It's because there were opportunities there for us that were not there for those before. And so what I very firmly believe is that you don't have to stay where you're put. Your life isn't necessarily set when you're born or when you're a child, and it can be changed.
Now, here's the thing. I mean, the title Chief Inspector of Prisons, of course, inevitably sounds very official indeed. But there you were as Chief Inspector of Prisons, not just with a clipboard having meetings. You would go into the cells of prisoners, as I understand it, and sit, I don't know where you sat, because there's not many places to sit, and sort of talk to these usually quite young men. Is that the case?
Yes, that's right. Quite often you'd have to sit on the loo because there would be no other space within the cell. There was one occasion that I've often remembered, which was a young man who was at risk of suicide. He was cutting himself, he was cutting his arms. And the prison staff thought that perhaps he wasn't quite their kind of prisoner and they might send him on. And I remember sitting and talking to him and him saying to me, please don't let them send me away from here, because all my life I've been passed around like a parcel. Mm. And sadly, I think that is true of the parallel lives of many of the young people who end up in prison. Now, that doesn't mean we've got to say, oh, poor things, we need to feel sorry for them. It means that we've got to do some really hard work, and they've got to do some really hard work to change the narrative of their lives.
When you were visiting all of these prisons, did you ever sit and think, as you were talking to these young men, what if this were my son? What would have had to have happened to him in the journey of his life that the story ends with this?
Oh, quite often, because I think what you experience when you talk to people, and particularly young people in prison, is that they have existed in a kind of parallel world. You know, whereas for my children and the children of the people I know, you know, they're going to school, they're thinking about what GCSEs to take, they're then working out what A-levels to take, what university to go to. Some of the children and young people I see in prison, life's been very different. They've gone into care, they've then graduated into a young offender institution, and they'll graduate into an adult prison if we don't do something about it. Because the trajectory from care into prison, very well-trodden one, that path, very well-trodden.
Let's go to the music then, Anne Owers. What's your first disc today that we're going to hear?
The first disc is from The Messiah, and it's Comfort Ye.
Comfort ye,
Philip Langridge singing Comfort Ye My People from Handel's Messiah with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by Neville Marriner. Why particularly did you want that disc, Anne Owers?
My father had a wonderful tenor voice. In fact, he won competition singing. But in the village where I was brought up, he was also the organist and choirmaster of the chapel, and he would produce and direct amateur operatic productions. Almost every small village, small workplace had its own amateur operatic society, usually doing Gilbert and Sullivan. My childhood was full of my father singing whatever it was he was rehearsing at the time. And, of course, reminds me also of the fact that he actually collapsed and died while he was conducting the choir that my mother and I were singing in. We were rehearsing for Easter Sunday. And in the middle of that, he died, which was awful for us, and obviously is a huge memory for me. But I think for him was exactly the moment. It was what he lived for, was music and singing.
How old were you at the time?
I was 15. I was just about to do my O levels.
Hugely traumatic.
So it was. Yes, it was. It was both for my mother, well, for the whole family, obviously. But I think for him was where he loved to be.
Now, you've mentioned that you were brought up in this very tight-knit mining community, and I do certainly want to talk about that, because the journey from there to Cambridge, as you say, the first generation, you were born in, was it 1947 you
yes,
were born?
Yes, that's right.
So you were the first of that generation. Before we do that, though, I'm interested just to put your professional life in a bit more context for people, because, of course, although they'll be familiar with your name, people aren't always sure how folk like you end up in jobs like that. So let's, for a moment, just trace that journey. You were Chief Inspector of Prisons, a job that you've given up. Before that, you led the legal pressure group Justice. You led a charity that campaigned for the welfare of immigrants, and you have been part of the Church of England's Race and Community Relations Board. Now, I'm wondering how you feel about the term do-gooder. Does it send shivers through your spine?
Yes, it does, for two reasons. First of all, that I'm not sure that anyone should set out to be a do-badder, but also because it's not just about doing the sort of Lady Bountiful act and the smile and wave and wave and smile. It's about addressing some very, very deep and very difficult problems to which there are no easy answers, but which actually demand an understanding of how things work and how people work. And the thing I think you said in your introduction, the thing that's always spoken to me is those people who are at the margins, those people who are felt not to matter, and the way that, as a society, we exclude people, we put people in the too difficult tray. And unless we expose that too difficult tray and do something with it, it will be not just a problem for them, but a problem for all of us.
Let's have some more music then, Anne Owers. What are we going to hear now?
We're now going to hear the Kinks singing Waterloo Sunset.
Now, it's obviously a cracker, but why else have you chosen it?
A number of reasons. First of all, I'm clearly a child of the 60s. This was music that was going on and going around when I was growing up. It was also music that, in those compromises you have to do in long car journeys with your children, it was music that was acceptable to them and to us. So it reminds me of my growing up, my children's growing up. But it also reminds me of Waterloo Bridge, which has to have the best view in London and which I've lived near for over 35 years.
Dirty old river, must you keep rolling? So busy, make me feel dizzy. Taxi light shines so bright, but I don't need no friend. As long as I gaze on Waterloo Sunset.
That was the Kinks and Waterloo Sunset. So, as you said, Anne Owers, a child of the 60s and a child originally of this Methodist church going family. It wasn't, though, just about the church. That's probably an important thing to understand. It was about community, was it? It was about social life. Things happened around the church. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. Life in the village was constructed, certainly for my family and for many families, around a church. There were actually three Methodist chapels in what was a very small village. That was where, you know, you made friends, you grew up, where you learnt country dancing, and as I say, where my father and my mother were part of the whole thing, from the Sunday school to the choir and so on. So it was a social event. It was also where I went to my first youth club, was in the basement of the Methodist chapel.
And your father was a joiner?
Yes.
What sort of bloke was he?
He was, I think, a very good joiner. He worked in the shipyards. He worked in the colliery. But I think his real life was his singing and his music and also writing. He wrote short stories and plays for amateur performance and so on. I think he was one of, you know, many people of his generation who, born a generation or two later, would have been able to do something quite different.
Let's have some more music then, Anne. What's next?
Next we've got June Tabor singing The Band Played Waltzing Matilda.
And you've chosen this, why?
I've chosen it because it reminds me very much of my grandfather's experience as a young 19-year-old who'd probably never been further than Newcastle in his life. He joined up in the First World War and was immediately sent to Suvla Bay. That was his first experience of being out of the northeast, his first experience of warfare. And he went on from there to be on the Somme, and he survived. But he survived with wounds that were internal. He had periods of great depression, and he came back and got on with it in the middle of the depression, in the middle of the miners' strike, and with all of those memories which he could never really share with people. And you only knew, almost by inference, how awful it had been.
And as a little girl, you were close to your grandfather.
I was very close to him, yes.
What sort of things would you do with him?
Well, we went for walks together every Sunday. We also went on the same walk. It was not. It was always the same. But we talked a lot, and I was very close to him. Yes.
And the band played Waltzing Matilda as our ship pulled away from the quay. Amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off to Gallipoli.
That was June Tabor, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, and memories there, strong memories, Dame Anne Owers, of your grandfather who fought at Gallipoli and went on to fight at the Somme. The bonds, of course, of the people who work and live around us are always strong, and especially you were talking about this community that you were brought up in, this Methodist mining community with three chapels in this tiny area. It's a very strong image. The approbation of our community is very important, the idea that we're abiding by the rules. Did you feel as you were being brought up that there were things that must be done and things that must not be done?
I think those communities have a very strong social cohesion, and therefore there are very strong social rules about what you do and don't do. I can remember, for example, the rules that were in my grandmother's head about hanging out washing, which were that there shouldn't be too much because that looked like showing off, but there shouldn't be too little because that looked as if you didn't have enough. So very strong social pressures, I think, on people. And as a child growing up, you were aware of those.
And that Methodist idea of sort of choosing not to sin, you know, that we are all capable of sin, but we are all also capable of making the choice not to sin. I'm wondering, in this society these days, where sort of everything's allowable as long as you talk about it, you know, that really, you know, it's all up for grabs. Would you like a little bit more of that sort of Methodist ideology to be ingrained in people's souls these days?
No, not really, because I think it comes the other way round. I don't think it's about rules. I think it is about people belonging somewhere, and that creates bonds of responsibilities and rights. I'm not a great fan of thou shalt not. I'm a much greater fan of this is how we will make it happen.
But of course, you know, the question then arises, well, thou shalt not worked quite well, because the one thing it did do was help people know how to behave, what the rules were, and potentially what might happen to them if they didn't stick to them.
I certainly think we individuals, communities, need boundaries, and those boundaries need to be clear. That's evident when you're bringing up children. There also has to be the opportunity for joint responsibility, for communal responsibility, for the recognition that within families and within communities you owe things to each other, you support each other. Simply the negative isn't going to achieve that. There's got to be the positive as well.
So where were the boundaries for you then? You told us terrifically dramatic ending to your father's life as he was conducting the choir, you and your mother singing in it, and your father died. Was it a heart attack he died of?
Yes.
And there you were about to sit your exams. How did you and your sister get back on to the job in hand, which was passing the exams and getting to university?
I think you do it a bit by shutting off, and you certainly did in those days. I can remember my mother rang up the head teacher of my school to explain what had happened and to say, you know, there may be some difficulties, to which the response came back, yes, but children don't feel that like adults do. And I think you were just expected to get on with it.
Did you feel isolated?
To an extent, yes. I think what happens is it comes back and hits you later. I can remember when I was at university, suddenly getting a panic attack and not knowing where it had come from, and realising, of course, that this was all part of what you have to go through. And it does affect you.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear now?
We're going to hear Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, which is well known to be the national anthem of South Africa, but it was also, the tune was the national anthem of Zambia, and when I left university, that's where I went to live. And that male close harmony singing was part of the singing I heard there. It was then I remember taking the children to see the film of Cry Freedom and them being hugely impressed by the film, but also by the experience there. And they then went to the Free Mandela concerts where it was sung. And then I had the great pleasure, when I was working at Justice, going back after the transformation and hearing it sung together with the Afrikaner national anthem. And it just brought a lump to everyone's throat, and it still does.
Nkosi Sikelel' Afrika, from the soundtrack of Cry Freedom. Anne Owers, you mentioned there that you spent time in your early married years living in Zambia. So you had at that point, of course, you'd graduated from Cambridge and you'd married just as you left Cambridge. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Just after we left, and then left straight away for Zambia.
Now, your mother then had seen you successfully through university. She'd seen you married and about to embark on married life, but she didn't see more than that.
No, very sadly she didn't. The last time I saw my mother was on my wedding day.
Right.
Very unexpectedly, and at a very young age, just in her 40s, she had a stroke just after we left for Africa, and then had a second stroke and died.
And she was only 47?
She was, yes, yes.
I wonder, you're now in your mid-60s. For a lot of people who've had, well, I suppose especially it's highlighted when both parents have died when they're young, is the idea that you make it past those milestones. Was that one for you? When you were 47, did you think, right, so does life go on after this?
I think you do. I think you feel yourself very lucky to have passed the milestones. My father was also quite young when he died. He was only 56, which for me now seems very young. But also I think you feel that you have a certain sort of responsibility. I mean, they were so important, my father and my mother in my life, that there's always part of me that feels that whatever is happening is partly for them.
And there you were at a pivotal moment in Zambia's history, because independence had been granted, what, about 4 years prior to you
yeah.
getting there. What state was the nation in?
It was a very exciting and optimistic time. Lots of things seemed possible, lots of things were different. When there were real movements in society, and people were being given, again, chances that they had never had before.
Let's have some more music then. We're on disc number 5 now, Anne Owers. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Kirite Kanawa singing Dove Sono from The Marriage of Figaro.
It's obviously very beautiful, but does it have other resonances for you?
It does. When I first moved to London and we had a house that was almost completely unfurnished, one of the first things we bought was a stereo record player. And I can remember sitting on the carpet, because we didn't have, at that stage, any chairs, which is just as well, because there was woodworm in the floor. And when we did get chairs, the chairs fell through the floor. And hearing this amazing voice from this woman whom I'd never heard of, whose name seemed very strange, and whose voice is just absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Kiri Tikenawa singing Dove Sono from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. So, Anne Owers, your first son was born in Zambia. That didn't hold any fright for you, did it? You weren't worried about that?
Well,
at all?
It should have done. I mean, if one of my children was to say they were going to do this, I'd be very nervous indeed. There was a mission hospital quite close to where we were, but between us and the hospital, there was what was called a drift, something which was normally a steep slope, dry, but in the rainy season could be feet underwater. And it was the rainy season, and if that had happened, we would have had about a 100-mile round-trip drive to get to the hospital. But in fact, it was perfectly all right. It was a great experience.
And you came back to London and had another two children, in relatively quick succession.
Yes.
Did you have an idea of getting your children out the way and then progressing with your career, given the fabulous education you'd had?
No, I didn't. I never really had that kind of plan. In fact, I've never really thought I had a career. I've just gone from one interesting thing that's really engaged me to something else. It was simply what seemed to be right at the time. And I think part of having children young too was about recreating a family.
And yes, that's an interesting one. And also this idea of where you were creating your family. You were in a far from affluent part of southeast London. Mm. You were in at the time. So that, I suppose, inevitably must have, just going about your day-to-day business, connected you with people who, some of whom were living on the margins, some of whom were much less fortunate than the rest of us.
Yes, it was a very mixed community, was Peckham. There were people who'd lived there all their lives. There was a relatively newly arrived West Indian community. There were young professionals coming to buy relatively cheap houses. But yes, I mean, one of the things that happened was that an advice centre was opened in the church hall, which was staffed almost entirely by volunteers. And it was doing the work there that first made me very aware of some of the problems, some of the hidden problems that people that I lived very close to were experiencing.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear now?
We're going to hear a chorus from the Christmas Oratorio.
And particularly, why have you chosen this?
I've chosen it because I simply love the music. I love the way that Bach uses the human voice and the orchestra, and it all weaves together. I love counterpoint. It's something that my husband and I listen to quite a lot. We were listening to it just before Christmas as we decorated the Christmas tree.
And do you still sing in a choir?
No, I don't. I have to say, I don't sing well. I mean, I love singing, but I wish I had a wonderful voice.
The Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque Soloists, conducted by John Elliot Gardner, performing Herr wenn dir Sturzen Feinde, Lord, if proud enemies rage, from Bach's Christmas Oratorio. So, Anne Owers, you were appointed as Chief Inspector of Prisons in, it was 2001. We are very fond, as a nation, of putting people in prison. During your time in the job, the prison population, I don't know if it was just the male prison population, increased by around about 20,000. That's a lot of people in prison.
That's right.
Do you ever worry that in the end, you know, the politics will decide how time in prison is spent and how many people spend their time in prison, and that it is, to a degree, time maybe not wasted, but maybe not well spent either?
I'm very clear that decisions about sentencing, decisions about how you use prison, those are political decisions, and they're quite rightly political decisions. But I think it's part of the job of an inspector to point out the consequences of what's happening. And the thing that saddened me greatly in the time that I was doing the job is that I think our prisons became better places, but they also became places that soaked up a lot of money and into which we put a lot of people. And my view is a lot of that money could have been better spent doing things that stopped people getting there in the first place and therefore prevented their being victims of crime, that provided alternatives, for example, for people with mental illness, and crucially also put money into the support afterwards, because you see so many people coming out of prison, and for some of them, they do want to be different. They do want life to be different, but actually life is the same, and some of the support that they've got in prison doesn't exist afterwards.
Are you one of those people who believe that we have got to, as much as we need to listen and understand and try to fix something that is broken, we also need to apportion blame? We need to say to people, you've made a mess of it and you need to take the responsibility for your actions?
I'm much keener on responsibility than I am on blame. One of the things that worries me about prisons is that they can take away responsibility from people. You put somebody in prison, they don't have to be responsible for themselves, when they eat, what they wear, whatever. They don't have to be responsible for what they've done. They don't have to be responsible to their families and to their communities. And prison can actually be a way of people not accepting responsibility for what they've done. And that's why I think some of the interesting moves in restorative justice, for example, are about a much more painful experience of actually confronting what you've done and sometimes confronting the person you did it to and not blocking it out. So I think responsibility is absolutely crucial.
Yes, I mean, the problem for all of us, of course, is where the high emotion that I also touched on comes in. You know, when people read in their newspapers that a prisoner is going to be called Mr. Gunn rather than Colin Gunn, you know, there was a case recently of somebody saying that he wanted the prison officers to call him Mr. Or, you know, we know that our Prime Minister, David Cameron, says he feels ill at the thought of certain prisoners being given the vote. Those are the things that get up our nose and under our skin when we feel that people who've made our world a worse place are somehow being granted the rights that actually only come once you've earned them.
I think there is an important thing about earning. I think there's an important thing about punishment. If we think about it more deeply, what kind of behaviour do we want to model to people whose own behaviour has often been seriously deficient? Do we want them to go out of prison thinking that if you have power over people, then you can use it to make them feel humiliated? Or do we want to put before them a different way of behaving? And that's not about being nice. It's about making demands. It's about challenging. It's about trying to change people.
Have you yourself ever been a victim of crime?
Yes, of course. You can't live in London for over 35 years and not have your house broken into, have your purse taken, have your children sometimes being attacked. And yes, and it makes you very, very cross.
Yes. Well, that's the problem, isn't
it? Of course.
Of course, that is
the problem.
Of course
it does. And that's absolutely right. Where I live in London, just 2 years ago, a young man was stabbed to death literally outside our house. And you're very close to that when you live in a big city.
And what about your own children then? A mother of three, as we know, your children now have grown up, and in fact, you're a grandmother. But were they explained the rules? Did you bring them up as Methodists, for example, as you were brought up?
No, my husband was a Church of England vicar, my first husband, and so they were brought up in the Church of England. We tried to do what all parents do, which is to grip boundaries, to make them turn into responsible adults.
Let's have some more music. What's next?
What's next is the Bach Double Concerto for oboe and violin.
And you've chosen this because?
I've chosen it because I think it's just a wonderful piece of music. And the adagio, which we're going to hear, has that amazing yearning quality. It's just a piece of music that always stops me in my tracks.
Part of the adagio from Bach's Double Concerto in D minor, performed by the German Bach soloists, led by Helmut Winschermann. So one of the problems, of course, about giving up a big job is that it leaves a It leaves a hole in your life, I suppose. What are you going to do next? What does the future hold, Anne?
Well, at the moment, I'm still doing work on prisons, but in Northern Ireland and in other countries. One of my colleagues who's also doing this with me said it's a bit like methadone maintenance. You know, it's a way of managing down the addiction. And the other thing that's taking up a lot of my time at the moment, and which is really interesting and exciting, is being chair of Christian Aid. And most recently, I went with Christian Aid to the Congo, DRC, where... You know, being someone who supports human rights doesn't just mean you might get a bad newspaper headline or someone out there might not like you. It can mean that you get killed. And I think for me it's part of that narrative we talked about earlier, which is the responsibility we have for people who live at the margins, for people whose lives matter. And whose lives matter to them and should matter to the rest of us.
And what about the rest of your life then? Your first marriage ended in divorce and you remarried just towards the end of your 50s. Where's time for all of that? Where's time for romance and laughter and love?
Well, I think that's the other thing, that we are trying and I hope we will succeed in creating more time for each other. We've had a couple of wonderful trips to Africa. We'd go walking and that and spending time with the grandchildren, of course, who are growing up.
You have four grandsons, is that
right? I have four grandsons and also two stepchildren too.
Your husband's a journalist, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Right, so does he give you advice about the press? I mean, given that you work in such an incendiary area, and as you said by your own admission, you know, it's highly politicised, the area of prison and our prisoners. Does he sit and give you a little bit of spin advice of an evening?
Certainly not spin advice. But yes, we do talk about how that works and also an understanding of how the press works, which I think sometimes people in my kind of jobs don't understand. We don't always agree about how you might present something, but certainly he's been a great source of strength and wisdom to me.
You mentioned your recent trip to the Congo. Of course, it is one of the most dangerous places on earth right now. Does he ever say, Anne, not the Congo?
He does get nervous, yes.
Yes.
That's certainly true. I also, just before Christmas, went to Kabul to do some training for the Afghan Human Rights Commission, which part of his job is inspecting prisons out there. So there have been some pretty edgy places, but I don't take unsensible risks.
Yes, you do. You look like a sensible person with your head screwed on, but are you a sort of secret adrenaline junkie then? Do you quite like being in these dangerous places?
Not at all. I'm a not very secret coward. I am a not very secret coward. So not at all. I'm not physically brave at all. But I rely on being with people who know what they're doing. And not taking risks.
And presumably you have to go through all the sort of hostage training and the hostile environment training, all that sort of stuff.
Yes, certainly. But I mean, I'm not really in a situation where that is going to be a great risk.
Well, you see, hostile environments, I'm thinking now of the island, potentially quite a dangerous place to be. Do you think you'll meet the challenge when I cast you away on this desert island?
I think I could meet some of the challenges. I think I am not, and if my husband were here, he'd be nodding furiously as we spoke. I am not a terribly practical person. I can do it, but it's not my greatest strength. So that would be a disadvantage. And I would just miss people hugely as well. I'd miss the spoken word.
So a final disc for comfort then. Let's find out what your final disc is going to be.
A final disc is Spare Min Allium. It's something that I've heard performed live on a number of occasions, along with my husband, but also along with a group of people, including a very dear friend who died not very long ago. It will always remind me of those occasions and of what one of us said as we sat there, that it's like being drowned in sound.
The opening of Thomas Tallis's Spem in Allium by the 16, directed by Harry Christophers. So we come to the books then, Anne Owers, the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And your book will be what?
This is even more difficult than choosing eight records. You're talking to somebody who packs at least two books more on holiday than she needs and then picks up two more in the airport just in case you run out of reading material.
Okay.
So choosing a book is just a nightmare. What I would choose is a book of poetry. The cadences of poetry, the way it's done, I think that would be something that would comfort me quite a lot.
So a good, bulky anthology of British poetry,
absolutely.
That'll do it for
yes,
you.
Yes.
OK, it's yours. And a luxury as well.
Ever since I was little, I've always written, mostly for my own pleasure, sometimes for other people, sometimes for work. It's something I love doing. It's something that in this generation now I can't do on paper because I never used to write very well and I can hardly write at all now. I would love to have a solar-powered word processor.
Right. No internet access, you know.
No, I accept that. I understand all of that. But if I couldn't talk to other people, I'd at least be able to talk to the screen.
Right. A good, simple, straightforward word processor is yours then. And the one disc that you would save, which one disc would it be?
I think if it was the whole of The Messiah, that would be it, because it's the first thing I ever sang with my father conducting, and there are, as well as Comfort You, there are just so many things that would remind me of a lot of events.
It's yours. Dame Anne Owers, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for asking me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.